This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, February 9th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. The IRS snooping on your Cash App, Venmo, and PayPal transactions has already begun. There are numerous problems with allowing it, but it also indicates a cultural problem inside federal agencies that, because the data exists, they should be able to access it. Cato's Nick Anthony and Julian Sanchez spoke with me on Monday. A lot of people engage in cash transactions. And in the more recent digital age, it has become relatively easier to engage in those kinds of transactions with an app. Venmo, Cash App, PayPal, any number of other applications that allow you to move a few bucks here and there. And now the IRS has the power, under certain circumstances, to gather information about those kinds of transactions. If you total up $600 worth of them in a year, and a lot of people do that. So how do we understand, first of all, the power of the IRS to do this? What limits their authority to snoop on my Cash App and say, Caleb, we think you've done something suspicious here and we need to investigate it?
Well, the chief way that they're using to step into this space is through the third party doctrine. And while it sounds pretty innocuous in passing, it's something that has been around in just about every space for the past 50 years or so, used as basically breaking it down to you have a right to privacy that's protected by the Constitution, but the government can intervene if you've allowed a third party to get involved with your privacy. So think of when you have a bank account, you give your money to the bank, or you give your money to a payment processor like Venmo. They suddenly become a third party in between you and the person you want to share your money with. And that alone gives them the authority to step in and essentially violate what should be protected by the Fourth Amendment.
This is nothing new. Of course, actually, one of the seminal decisions in which that third-party doctrine was articulated involved the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970. And so it's not new for the government to impose reporting requirements on financial institutions. For a very long time, banks, for example, have had to report transactions of over $10,000 in order to police money laundering. And of course, the IRS will also investigate people who make transactions a little under $10,000 who are suspected of trying to avoid the $10,000 reporting limit. And Inspector General investigations have found that very often those investigations are not terribly well conducted and end up wasting the time and causing a lot of stress for people who weren't, in fact, doing anything wrong. What's new here in a rule change that was sort of snuck into the American Rescue Plan and actually took effect on January 1st is, whereas previously these sort of third-party payment processors like Venmo and Cash App and PayPal had to file 1099s when or issue 1099s when you had an account with transactions over $20,000 and over 200 transactions a year, which is to say, you know, a real business making substantial income via that app, that has been reduced to $600 now. And that means you're going to sweep in a whole lot of data about, pretty low level, sort of transactions that essentially in a previous era are transactions that would have been done in cash. Wouldn't have, probably wouldn't have been reported at all. Frankly, probably wouldn't have occurred to most people. $600 a year, that's effectively, $50 a month, might not even count as the kind of thing it would register with people as something that needs to be reported income. And IRS says they're not talking about transactions where that are, for example, people sharing the cost of a meal or splitting the cost of a vacation rental or something like that, interpersonal kind of payments sharing, but only business transactions, payments for goods and services. But again, that too, brings in a lot of stuff that people wouldn't normally think of as stuff that you need to report as taxable income, like offloading some old property on eBay, the kind of stuff you used to get rid of at a garage sale. So you're talking about a kind of granularity of reporting here that's going to flood the IRS with data about, I think, potentially much, you know, smaller level transactions, you know, kind of side hustles on Etsy or eBay. And one effect of that is that you're now potentially going to be investigating people who, again, either are just sort of disposing of personal property to make money, or, you know, making very small amounts of income through some kind of side work. And unlike people who are investigated for making $10,000 transactions, are often going to be people who have a lot fewer resources to defend themselves against an intrusive IRS investigation, people who may not have the ability, for example, to lawyer up in response. And, you know, it's often, you know, this is stressful and potentially unfair, you know, whether you have resources or not. But it's you know, more disturbing when you consider that you're setting the stage for what are likely to be a large number of sort of false positive investigations into folks who are not, you know, big money tax sheets and are not really very well equipped to push back against a massive federal agency prying into their finances and asking for a detailed accounting of, you know, what they sold on eBay last year.
All right. And Nick, leaving all that aside, the IRS is terrible at giving Americans advice about their own taxes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's become just a trope that you go in and you ask for help from the IRS, and depending on who you get, you'll get a different answer. And Julian couldn't be more right that we have a system that is ostensibly claimed to be to catch the big tax cheats. And yet it's targeting everyone at the bottom, and all those people are going to need help to better understand their taxes. And yet when they go into the IRS to get help, to try to get clarity about what exactly is going on, it's not clear that they're going to get it at any point.
I think it's very telling that the same legislation that included this rule change ramped up funding for IRS enforcement and provided 20 times more funding for increased enforcement than it did for increased taxpayer assistance. So there's more resources for the IRS to investigate and pursue people, you know, some of whom maybe should be pursued, but a lot less resources to help people understand what they need to do to comply with the tax laws. So, you know, not enough resources to explain what you need to do to be in the clear and to comply with the law, but a lot more resources where if you make a mistake, perhaps because you didn't get good advice from the IRS, to go after you for that mistake.
You know, leaving all of this aside, it's just at least a little troubling and creepy to know that this idea, just to balance out the accounting of a very expensive piece of legislation, got past a couple of guys at a water cooler, got past the agency generally approving of it, got past a bunch of lawmakers who wanted to approve it, and then passed into law. And it just seems like if you had to ask the median voter, this is what we're going to do. These are the transactions we are going to start collecting and snooping on. I guess it speaks to just a weird cultural state of agencies about what they feel like they're entitled to from Americans.
It is a very strange culture to think that this is something that is fine to put forth. I mean, you're absolutely right that maybe at the lunch table, this is something that might come up as an interesting conversation. But when you go through stage after stage after stage and not ask yourself, is this really the right thing to be doing? Should we really be taking what is protected by the Constitution and circumvent it for what is going to be bottom of the line data? It really makes no sense. And I think you're absolutely right that this reflects a larger cultural change that's taking place here. I mean, there was even one point, consider the bank reporting threshold that came up last year where it was originally going to be $600. Now, when all the debates came forth and everyone was saying, we are not okay with this, this is not something that we want to see happen in this country, all of a sudden it was pulled back and they said, we are going to change it from $600 to $10,000 because that's a number people are more used to. People are more familiar with that threshold. And while there is truth in that, that there's bank reporting that's already taking place at the $10,000 threshold, clearly it shows how they view it if they're going to accept it as this is something that we'll meet you in the middle, we'll have a nice change of pace, something you're more comfortable with, when in reality, I don't think anyone is comfortable with being snooped on like this.
And Julian, as a related matter, I know Ron Wyden has been critical of the IRS recently for their plan to require facial recognition or face ID in order to have an online account with the IRS.
Yeah, as an attempt to crack down on identity theft and identity fraud, which is indeed a real problem worth addressing. They've contracted with an outside company called ID.me. And the plan essentially is to access your online IRS records, your tax records. You would have to upload effectively a kind of video selfie to provide a kind of face recognition credential in order to log in. There are, I think, a whole bunch of problems with that idea. For one, this is an idea that the kind of government identity verification site login.gov, which is run by the General Services Administration, considered, again, as the sort of the entity responsible for building an identity verification portal for government websites, looked at face recognition and said, no, we don't think this is a good idea for a bunch of different reasons. Despite that, we have IRS now saying, although given the backlash, we'll see whether or not this goes forward, but saying, oh, we're actually going to require you to upload biometric data and, in fact, provide that biometric data to a private external contractor as a condition of having access to your own tax records. There's a bunch of problems with that. I mean, there's a well-known issue with the reliability of face recognition, in particular with respect to non-white faces. The error rate, at least traditionally, has been higher for Black and Asian faces, for example. Those error rates have come down as the technology has been refined, but it sort of remains to be seen how much that that actually works in the wild when you have people, uploading selfies or taken maybe under non-ideal conditions, non-ideal lighting. There's the issue of revocability. I mean, there's a question of whether biometrics are the right identity verification mechanism for a lot of things, especially, logging into thing online. And that's because one kind of traditional security criterion is revocability of credentials. That is, in the event a security credential is compromised, you want the ability to revoke it. So, oh, there was a hack, your passwords got out, you need to change your password to protect your security. Well, you can't change your face. Or, I mean, you can, but
it's very expensive.
Usually it's pretty expensive. Or, I mean, you can do it cheaply, but the results aren't great. If you've got a hammer in your toolbox. Which, of course, that's another problem, right? I mean, people do have accidents and incidents that alter their faces sometimes. That's going to create an issue. Anecdotally, this particular company has had issues where, people find a failure of verification for whatever reason, and then end up having to wait hours for a kind of customer service person to resolve the issue because they didn't have enough personnel staffed up in order to resolve it. So I think there's a whole bunch of reasons to find this dubious, but in particular, for kind of anti-fraud reasons, the biometric data that's collected by this external company is going to have to be stored for several years, and I think there's kind of the additional good question of, what other uses might be made of that biometric data? So I think there's a question of, how quickly do we want to move at mandating, in effect, the creation of this very large database of biometric data of large numbers of people stored by a third-party private company that the government has access to, and not a lot of thought put into what other potential uses might end up being made of that database.
And the IRS can't even secure the tax records of the richest people on the planet.
Right. I mean, there was a recent substantial data leak from IRS. And, you know, private companies all the time have these kind of large scale data leaks. And, you know, it's one thing to say, well, look, you know, you may take the risk of providing private information to your Facebook or some other company and, you know, hacks happen and maybe it's exposed. But when you're talking about something like access to your tax records, which you are required to submit, right? Interfacing with a government agency that you don't really have a choice about engaging with and interfacing with, I think you want a much higher bar when you're saying, well, what kind of data are you forced to provide to them to and you know to put into a large and potentially vulnerable database. I think given the absence of real choice about whether to participate in that, we ought to have a pretty high necessity threshold when we're asking people to turn over data.
Nick Anthony manages the Cato Institute Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. Julian Sanchez is a Cato Senior Fellow. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice. And follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.